Hi, I'm Tony Amendola. I play Master Braytak on Stargate SG-1, and I am listening to Sci-Fi Talk.
On this edition of Sci-Fi Talk, I have a conversation with a very funny and talented actor, Brian Downey, who is, of course, Stanley Tweedle on the television series Lex. Sometimes you just don't know where a conversation is going to go based on the questions you ask, such is the case with my conversation with Brian Downey. And let's not waste any time and go right to it.
We actually met before.
Where do we meet, man?
At ICON. On Long Island in New York.
ICON, Long Island, my God, like about 5, 6, 7 years, I don't know, a long time ago.
In 02.
In 02?
In 02, in 2002.
Yeah.
You were there, and we ended up, it actually was supposed to be like a press conference, but we ended up just me interviewing you. And I remember very well because, I mean, I guess this is the way your thought process worked. You started talking about the Warner Brothers cartoons.
Did I?
Yep. And you were talking about how Daffy and Bugs always do the, you know, rabbit season, duck season kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I responded to that because I always thought that was funny. And then the thing about the frog, too, you know, hello, my baby.
Oh, the best cartoon ever.
Yeah.
I remember that. Still is, as far as I'm concerned.
And actually ended up happening was... he was actually at the time going to be the symbol for the WB network, and he is the WB network symbol. Unfortunately, WB is going to be no longer in September, so the frog is going to be put out to pasture.
Oh, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
Put back in his box for another millennium.
I think so, I think so. So, you know, maybe he'll
got
be...
all that talent. What a waste.
Exactly. Maybe he'll be true to form as he was in the cartoon and just sit there and not do anything.
Yeah. The next fool comes along.
Exactly, exactly.
That was interesting.
Yes, that was a fun interview. We covered a lot of good ground. And at the time, Lex was just, I think it just finished or just about to finish.
Well, what month would that have been?
That would have been March of 02, I think.
March of 02, and we had, if that was March of 02, and we were in Thailand.
Right.
And we wrapped the end of October.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it was just a few months before.
Yep.
Wow, that's
something. Yeah.
What was that like for you when you knew that it was the last shot for Lex and it was over?
I don't. Well, it's kind of strange. I think there was more kind of a sense of farewell in when our last shots came up in Nova Scotia than in Thailand. Although Thailand was like that. That was it. That was the end.
Yeah.
But, in fact, we'd already been through an end once before because, you know, I mean, we had what we refer to sometimes, some people in the industry refer to as a guerrilla crew.
Yeah.
In Thailand. We had a very small crew. We had, we picked up some guys, in Japan and in Thailand, really good guys for the most part, but we picked up a couple of lighting guys, some grips, but not a whole lot else. Our crew, we had a sound guy, we had a camera operator, and a focus puller, two camera guys, you need two camera guys. We had a person who was acting as first AD, and
right.
Second AD, and one person, Caroline Richards, and we had a guy who was acting as producer, production coordinator, and Paul Donovan did directing.
Yeah.
That was it.
Wow.
That was it. And the cast, three cast people.
Wow.
Well, actually, we ended up with more than that because Ralph was there, Patricia was there for a while. So Patricia, Ralph, and Louise, in addition to Michael and Xenia and myself.
Yeah.
That's a very compact unit.
Yeah, I would say. I would say.
That as opposed to Halifax, where we had still like the 80, 90 odd guys on the crew, and in addition to all of us being there, we had all those other guys that we work with. Some of these guys we'd work with for four seasons, you know, some
yeah.
for two, some for three, and some for that, even if it's just for that entire year. What quite often happens in the business is there's a kind of a, if not in reality, it's felt to be a separation between cast and crew. Sometimes producers will tell crew guys not to talk to the actors. Don't talk to the actors.
Hmm.
And sometimes they're told, don't look at the actors. how can they not look at the actors? Come on. And actually, I just finished doing a shoot with Jessica Lange.
Nice.
And Joe Beth Williams.
Wow.
And somebody on the crew told me that very same thing. Said we were, well, some of us on the crew, we were told not to look at the actors. I said, don't be so stupid. Well, here are you and I talking. It's not a big deal, you know. I mean, what? Some actors can be very testy about it. Some crew members, I'm talking basically about, you know, Teamsters, they can be really kind of, they can feel very territorial.
Okay.
About their position.
Sure.
And they feel like they, if not for them, nothing would happen.
Hmm.
But I've never felt that to be true, and most of the guys, I think all the guys that we work with in Halifax and all of us that ever worked as actors, well, I mean, think of maybe one, maybe two exceptions that ever had any problem socializing, intermingling, talking, you know, chatting about all sorts of things, making jokes or talking politics or discussing the nature of the universe and global warming, you know, world of, no problem talking about anything at all with any member of the crew.
That's cool.
Well, I think it's the way it should be because, you know, my view of it all is that that the whole process forms, for lack of a better analogy, it's like a circle. And the circle begins with somebody like Paul Donovan getting an idea. He wants to get this crazy idea about a show and about a spaceship and very strange crew members. And he's thought about it because he likes chaos theory and he likes the idea that everybody is really out for themselves in the end. And maybe our definitions or our definition of heroes or heroism is just all wrong.
I mean, right.
You know, and leadership has been defined in a way that makes for leaders not to be able to work. So other people take that position, you know. I mean, what's George Bush doing leading the free world? Come on. You know, he's got a guy for it. It's like, man, it's like Roy Rogers and Gabby Hayes. except that Gabby Hayes got a few more brains, you know. But and he just, like, he's shooting the wrong people. I mean, you know. Come on. And then, I mean, it's like talk about Bugs Bunny and,
yeah,
like, the Roadrunner.
Yeah.
The guy that gets shot apologizes. Wait a second. What do you mean? Did something ricochet off him and hit Dick Cheney? Be sorry for that? What could he, what's he get to be sorry for? Sorry, I didn't mean to get in the way of your lousy aim. He's apologizing. It's like he's saying, well, I should have known better. It was Dick with the gun. I really should have known better. You know, when I see Dick with a gun, usually I run. Is that what he's saying?
I don't know. I haven't figured that one out.
It's like, man. And then they don't talk about it for days.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it all. Dick Cheney goes to Wyoming, goes to the, you know, the do they call it a Senate in Wyoming? The Assembly of Representatives?
No, it's the State Assembly, I would think.
The State Assembly. Go talk to the State Assembly. They give him a standing ovation.
Yeah, well.
Would they have nominated him for King of the World if he actually killed a guy? He shot a guy, and they give him a standing ovation.
Only in America.
It's just, to me, it's like, wow, this is so bizarre, you know.
Yeah, it is. It is. It was definitely a very strange situation.
So anyway, as I was saying, so, you know, Paul gets a strange, gets an idea based on some things that were around him, because ideas don't come out of the blue. All these things get absorbed into your subconscious, and they come spilling out at some point in the form of not a full-blown idea, but at least a partially blown idea. It's like a balloon on the way to the party, but maybe it's not, you know, the kids haven't got the balloon yet. So he gets this idea, and he develops it to a point where he figures he needs other writers, somebody to bounce ideas off, somebody that's going to, like, create and give him more push toward achieving what he wants to achieve. So the writers develop some ideas, and then they start to complete some scripts. And it gets to the point where Paul's gone out, he's raised money, he's got this idea, we did a demo.
Yes.
Then he's able to hire designers, people that can do post-production, like he explains to the designers what he wants in post-production in terms of the computer-generated images.
Yes.
Maybe hires, you know, costume people to design some things, give him some ideas, and all those sorts of things gets refined to the point where they know they can start hiring other technicians, people that are going to manage the money, people that are hired to manage some of the higher levels in the production team. They've been hired. So they start to work in a more complete way, in getting down closer to the day when you finally get before camera, hires a cameraman, the lighting guys, the lighting designer, the lighting guys, the guys that set up all the stuff in the studio, the guys that build all the stuff that goes into the studio, and then they hire actors. I didn't audition. Paul just gave me a phone call, and he auditioned some other people, but that happens. And then we get onto the floor, we shoot some stuff, it goes to the post-production people, it goes to the editing room, it gets cut, it gets refined, music is added by the composer, they've already had discussions, they know what kind of music,
yes.
It all gets done, it goes to a final print, it gets sent off to a broadcaster, the broadcaster has his dates all lined up, and at some point the thing goes on the boob tube, goes on the television, people sitting in the living room watch it. They respond to us. They write letters, or they give us ratings. But in some way, but personal contact is your only true affirmation, or true a real sense of the barometer of like how people are liking it and what they like.
Yeah.
And we get that kind of feedback, the personal feedback, and then we give the feedback. We say thanks, and that's the circle.
Yeah, it is. It's like a circle, isn't it?
That's where it's complete. And I said to producers one time, I was. When fans were coming in 2001, I said, "Yeah, I was getting T-shirts together and getting I rented a couple of bars and where fans could go and we could get the crew together with the fans and just have a sociable evening with everybody."
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh well, come on, just toss $500 in, just from production. Come on, everybody else is pitching in something. I'm footing most of the bill, but some of the guys are tossing in some stuff. They're going to be there. They're going to spend time, and they're going out of their way somewhere. What about you guys? Come on, $500. What do you say?" They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. And they thought they had reasons. Nigel and I said to these guys, listen, it's not the producers that keep the show in the air. It's not the actors that keep the show in the air. It's not the directors. It's the fans that keep the show in the air. So you're just saying, I'm more important. And what I'm saying, what I said to them was that, listen, and I described this circle to them. I defy you. If you pull any one element of that circle out, what happens? It falls apart.
Yeah.
It falls apart, man, and that's it. So, I don't know. I didn't convince them in the end, but that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah. No, you're right. It is a circle, and it is. You take a piece of it out, and it's no longer.
That's right.
It doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
It really is, there's a synergy that's needed to keep it going, and so it's like a well-run machine,
Yeah.
So you don't have that. It's just ain't there.
I think our machine wasn't so well oiled, but we creaked along.
It ran.
It did run.
It did run.
Like the Model T.
You know? Yeah. Well, it had the
not so many moving parts.
It had the movies first, and then it became a full blown out series.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing it was it was on all over the world really, and
yeah.
That's where your fan base is, all over the world.
About 160 countries.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is kind of amazing.
I think those Friday nights on the Sci-Fi Channel, when it was your show, preceded by Farscape,
mm-hmm.
I was actually telling Michael McManus about that. I thought those were very special Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe they were. They were really something special because you literally would tune in every week and not have any friggin' clue what we were going to see.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
Yep.
That's exciting.
It is, and I think it's a good turn for broadcast sci-fi to take.
No doubt about it.
The written word has always been a lot more adventurous and a lot more daring and some, in lots of ways a lot more revealing and a lot more poetic than broadcast TV.
Sure.
But I think it's good that, people say, look, come on. For instance, when we finished the four and we knew we were going to come back and do the series, Paul asking different people for ideas. And I said, one of the things that's always kind of bugged me, we always had the rules, right? Gravity is presumed to exist.
Right.
Stanley Tweedlesoe never lose his hat. what was another one? Oh, yeah, in all of our adventures, I don't remember exactly, but it was very much like this. In all our adventures, we shall never encounter an entity that is more intelligent than human beings, unless that entity agrees to write that episode.
Yeah.
I love that one.
That's a good one. That's a good rule.
this other one too, which is kind of a dig at, you know, early Star Trek, and still some stuff that's still going on. In space, there are no floating heads.
Okay, good.
I like that one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah,
there's a lot of floating heads out there right now.
I think it's become easy, too easy, and I think it's a bit boring. It's boring. I speak for myself, of course. To watch shows that are sci-fi shows in which the characters are organized in a militaristic kind of order. There's a captain who's the captain, and his word is the word, and there's the first officer. It's like it was the USS Enterprise.
Right.
It's a space ship. The emphasis was on ship, not on space.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And it was that kind of order, which I find, man, there's enough of that, you know, in the world. There's enough of that in the news. There's enough of that in so many other kinds of shows, cop shows and all kinds of others. And I thought, shouldn't space, the future, be about limitless possibilities, mm-hmm. not about limiting possibilities?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
That's what that military order does. It's like, we want to go to a place where, like, anything can happen, and there doesn't have to be a reason.
Yes.
It doesn't have to pass through a certain kind of construct. It can just happen.
Yes.
I loved it. For instance, Barry Bostwick loved it, too.
Yeah.
When him playing Thoden,
yes.
you know, gets in a fight with Kai,
yes.
to be invisible, doesn't quite make it, and then he's going to make this great dying speech, you know? He's going to wax Greek on us, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Offer a wax Shakespearean. And he just goes, I, Thoden, plunk. It's like, come on, man, you're dead. You're not going to give a speech, you know? It's like, so I thought, that's perfect. See,
yes.
That's what happens. You know, you don't get to do what you want to do all the time.
Right.
People are mostly self-serving in most situations.
Mm-hmm.
And heroism is not about, you know, taking on a bunch of bad guys single-handedly. It's about saying, oh, Christ, I really don't want to do this, but if I don't do it, they're going to get hurt, which is going to really piss me off, so okay, I'll do it. And that's heroism is an accident of an action. It's not the action you want to take. Nobody says, I'm going to be a hero and save the day. No, you say, like, oh Christ, if I don't do this, I'm really screwed, and then it looks like heroism.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like other people, I think most people would never say that about themselves, that, you know, I was very heroic in that situation.
I think what's going to happen this year is something very special at Timeless Destinations, which you'll be appearing at in August,
mm-hmm.
Is that there's going to be a Lex reunion. And actually, Michael told me that he hasn't seen, Xena since the show ended.
That's probably quite true, yes.
So it's like the three of you will be together for the first time, probably in a while. And then Ellen will be there, too, who is your Jake Arata, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think it's going to be like for you when all of you are together there again? Well, you think it'll be like the old days? A lot of things will just come back to you, and you'll kind of fall into your old chemistries together.
I really, that's a virtually impossible thing to predict. I mean,
yeah.
I think my comfort level is just fine. You know, I mean, I've seen everybody. I think as a matter of fact, everybody that played an ongoing role in the show, I have seen more than once since we wrapped. About this time last year, a bit earlier than this last year, actually, I was working with Rolf.
Oh, there you go.
Richard Donat, who did the original demo and played in the first episode, and some other people. I've been with Patricia at the conventions, and Louise, and I've seen them socially in Toronto. I've seen Jeff Hirschfeld. Nigel lives in Nova Scotia, so I see him from time to time. Nigel does a fair bit of stage work.
Yes.
I saw Michael here back in, maybe November, October, November, something like that, I think. Maybe even later than that.
When's the last time you saw Xena?
Xenia?
Yeah, Xenia.
When was the last time I saw Xenia? It would have been at a convention.
Oh, okay.
And I can't really remember, but Michael wasn't there. Xenia was there, you know.
Right.
And Louise and Patricia and Jeff, and I see Lex from time to time, Lex Jigaroff.
Yes.
And, of course, I was working with Paul.
Yes.
On the conclave, and I talked to him. Last time I talked to Paul, I guess, was back in September before he was heading off to spend from September till Christmas in Berlin.
Yeah.
With his family.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen everybody. So to me, it's like, okay, so now instead of seeing everybody, it's like, you know, one here and one over there and one back here. It's like, okay, so now we're together.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be fun. I think it'll be great to see you guys and to see you all on stage. And I think the fans will get a real kick out of that. Because I understand there's going to be quite a few Lex fans coming. So that'll be nice.
The one, I would really, really, really like to see Bill invite Jeff Hirschfield. Jeff is great, and Lex Jigarov too. Two of those guys together, man, do they spin off each other? You might as well just sit down and shut up for an hour, because you'll be more than amused. You'll probably be like on the floor laughing your guts out, you know. And they're also very bright too.
Yes.
And but the ideas just keep coming, and the repartee, those guys get along like a house on fire. They work really, really well off each other.
Cool.
You know, obviously that was the impetus, I guess, for Paul hiring them to do the writing.
Sure.
They're just full of ideas and full of wit and good intellectual strength. And I loved working with Jeff on stage. Was great. Like we've done it, those things in front of audiences, like taking questions and asking questions of the audience as well. And it's just a hoop because we play off of each other. And I think one of the things that as you sort of intimated a little while ago, is that there's a chemistry that becomes even more palpable when we're all together.
Yeah.
It's like we're a group, and we know we're a group, and we know we get along, and we know that the sum of us is greater than adding up each person's talent or strength. The sum of all that is stronger and better. And one of the things I always liked about it, I've worked on a lot of sets, is that it is always very, I don't know a better word than human. It was very human. It was very down to earth, had some laughs, a lot of respect, a lot of care. All those things that you think of as valuable human qualities were there, and everybody felt they were there. I mean, there was no question.
That's cool.
Right to this day. Pick up the phone, talk to Louise, or talk to Jeff, or talk to Lex, and it's like, hey, you know, it was yesterday. We're just getting ready talking about something. We're going to go off to work tomorrow together. You know, there's that feeling of it's a continuous thing.
Yes.
We had that feeling back then, and just because you're not working together anymore, that the knowledge that you can get along, that you do get along really well, just stays with you. It's like it's a real kinship. It's like brothers and sisters.
Mm, yeah. Oh no, it's great. I mean, when you have it, it's fantastic. I think what was what's great about Lex, especially towards the end, I think it was really spot on satire. You know, I mean, certainly we as Americans got our shots, but I thought we took it in the spirit it was given. It was very, very funny and good satire, and we have no problem with our leaders being shown in a mirror, and it was all in good fun, and we certainly enjoyed that part of it. And it was, to me, that's the thing I remember most, is that it was, you know, at times very good biting satire. It really was. It was right on target.
The reason that America was played more than other countries,
mm-hmm.
was that we knew that was going to be a huge portion of the audience for the show.
Right.
We knew it was going to play in the United States. The deal had been made. It was a done thing there and Britain. But we could have said exactly the same things about like almost any country on earth.
Sure.
I mean, right here in Canada now, it's just stupid. You know, we've got a new government, and they're not talking to the press. They've been told by the new prime minister and the deputy prime minister, all the other elected representatives, don't talk to the press.
Oh, God.
They're not allowed to talk to the press. Before they were sworn into office, we have essentially a two-party system, but there are any number of parties. It's much like in Great Britain. It's a parliamentary system. So
right. The
three principal parties were the conservatives, the liberals, which is not a description of their political leanings. It's a description. That's the party's name.
Right.
From ages, from like, you know, a century and a half ago.
Exactly.
It has nothing to do with modern politics. It's just the name. And liberals aren't liberals, man. Let me tell you, they're tightwads. They're about the bucks. both parties are about the bucks. But so conservatives, liberals, and the new Democrats, which are definitely more in tune with the general population in terms of, like, you know, developing good social programs, making
right.
sure kids get education and that then child poverty becomes a thing of the past, and helping homeless people, things that really should matter to everybody, but these people actually try to do something about it. So it was a very close election, and the conservative leader now is a very conservative guy. I mean, he's badass right-wing guy.
Oh, God.
Stephen Harper, yeah, I know. It's not going to be good for the country.
Hmm.
Luckily, Canada never has gone too far left or right. We're not that kind of country. So the fear that people express is just, it's idiotic. But before the government was sworn in, or the day they were sworn in, a guy from the other party crossed the floor of the House and joined the Conservatives. A guy from the Liberal Party joined the Conservative Party.
Huh?
You did what? And they say, well, it's okay. He just likes us. He doesn't even know you. He's got a cabinet post. He's now a minister. His salary automatically doubled or tripled. This guy named David Emerson. And now there's a movement. The people that elected him are in an area in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And they're calling for an un-election. They want to, like, take a vote and unelect him.
So
I think you ought to do it, guys. You ought to do it. You like, all these people worked hard. They raised money for the guy. You know, private citizens contributing to his election campaign. And before the House of Assembly, it's like the House of Representatives, is even called, he says, I'm not with those guys anymore. I'm with the other guys. Think, like, you know.
Oh, God. It's amazing politics. It seems to cross all borders, but you can almost tell that story here in this country, too. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, political opportunism is not, it's not particular to any one country.
Exactly.
And idiotic leadership, or what we call leadership, is not particular to any given country.
No.
You know. It's sad, but it's true.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Now, you did mention you worked with Jessica Lange, great actress, and also another great actress, Jo Beth Williams. Can you talk about that project? Because I had heard you had done it, and I was going to bring it up, but since you were there first. What was this about?
Well, it's a remake, and it's no secret about what it is, because you can find it on the Internet.
Right.
Go to Jessica Lange's. Jessica Lange, and there's another brilliant, brilliant, brilliant young woman whose name is Tammy Blanchard.
Oh, okay.
Who worked with her. She's an Emmy Award winner, and she was nominated for a Tony on Broadway for Gypsy.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, how can you be nominated? You're like 12 years old. She's 29. I didn't know. But she's one of those faces that's going to be young forever.
Yeah.
And a demeanor, too. Very nice woman. It's a remake of a piece called Sybil, S-Y-B-I.
The multiple
personality.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Based on a true story.
Oh, of course.
Made, I think, about 20 years ago, maybe.
Yes.
Some time ago.
Yes, it was.
With Joanne Woodward.
That's right.
Psychiatrist.
Yes, that's right. And Sally Field, I believe.
And Sally Field.
Yes.
The
Sybil, yeah.
Sybil.
Yeah.
And it was sort of pretty much the role that defined Sally Field as an actress to be taken seriously.
Exactly.
Before, she was the flying nun.
Yes, I know. I remember her very well.
So, but, you know, I think and I think she might have won an Emmy for that. I'm not certain.
I believe she did. I believe she did win an Emmy.
Yeah. And this young woman, Tammy, is playing Sybil.
Cool.
Jessica is playing the psychiatrist.
Wow, that's nice.
Dr. Wilbur, who discovers that and proposes the idea to the psychiatric community that this woman has something like 16 distinct personalities.
Exactly, yeah.
And it was great, and I played Sybil's father.
Hmm.
Jo Beth Williams played her mother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we all got along great. It was a good shoot. And one of the things that made it enjoyable, I think, for everybody was the director. The director's name was Joseph Sargent.
Oh, sure. He's a great director.
He's an amazing director.
Yeah, he's a good veteran director. Yeah.
The guy's about 80 years old.
Oh, yeah, he's been directing for years, yeah.
He's got the energy of a 16-year-old cat on the prowl.
That's great.
Yeah, he's really, really sharp. And the lovely thing about him was that he saw and heard everything.
Oh, sure.
And he knew how to describe the nuance that he wanted without giving line, what we're going to call line readings.
Right.
Like, well, what do you think about this? And he posed questions, gave little suggestions, said, it's not right there. We need to tweak it a little bit or pull it back a little bit, you know. Said, okay, I think I know what you mean. And it was just, it was amazing. It's amazing. It just like, you know, I know that Jessica and Joe Beth and they all thought, oh, this guy is so freaking good. It's a real nice treat to be able to work with somebody who's that accomplished.
Oh, yeah.
And who was that good at his craft, at his art. I mean, he's just that good. The guy started working back in black and white TV.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Gunsmoke, The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
I believe he directed the original Star Trek. He directed some of the episodes.
Star Trek. He directed Star Trek way back when, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And just piles of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a list of credits that's
as a mile long, as they say, and longer, maybe.
Yeah, it wraps around the world, I think.
I think it could be.
Pretty long, yeah.
Could be. The man's a legend, really, when you think about all those things that he's done. So to have
absolutely
that opportunity.
And the thing is, a gentleman, too.
Oh, that's great.
Great sense of humor.
Great.
A real gentleman. Never raised his voice. Never had to. Because
yeah,
he's the kind of guy that you just, I don't know, he's got a certain kind of charisma. People gravitate toward him, and people listen to him. People are paying attention. We also had a Norman Stevens was a production guy. He was there on set every day. We did a lot of exteriors. It was freezing cold. This is producers can have the option. Just go in, put their leg warmers on, have a cup of coffee, get out of the cold. But he stuck it out.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah,
that's
good
nice
guy. Real good guy. Done for the Wolper, what do they call themselves? Wilbur Aiden, production office. You know, the David L. Wolper.
Okay. Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. So it's going to be a miniseries, you think? Or as opposed to...
No. I think it's
just a two-hour?
A one-off, yeah. MOW. It's for CBS.
Oh, great. Great. Great.
Play the stage. And coming up, there's another one going to be working on. Actually, starting a week from today, a week from yesterday, I can't remember. With Kate Beckinsale.
Oh, wow.
And,
nice.
And Sam Rockwell.
Wow, Sam Rockwell's great.
Sam Rockwell's really good.
He's very talented.
We've had a couple of rehearsals together.
Oh, he's just out there, man.
And it's just ideas. And
yeah.
That I think it's a longish script that I'm not sure. I have a feeling that also will be an MOW, and for whom I don't really know.
Those are great people to be working with lately. That's really good.
Yeah,
that's terrific.
It's interesting.
Oh, I would say. I mean, if you saw Hitchhiker's Guide, you know that Sam Rockwell can be like all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, he took his own spin on that character and really did an excellent job with it. So I'm very happy with his work. Really going back even to Galaxy Quest too, which was.
Oh man!
I mean, he had this signature line in the movie when Tony Shalhoub's character, who's no slouch of an actor either, is making out with the alien. He goes, "Oh, that's not right." You know, it's kind of like he said what the audience would say too. Because
yeah,
no, that's not right.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of funny lines like that. He played the spoof of the Star Trek red shirted crewman, who, you know, the crewmen that die every week because they're wearing a red shirt. You know, speaking of red and shirts and things, Michael mentioned that he actually has his Lex costume.
Oh, does he?
Do you have any of your costumes from Lex at all? Did you save any?
I don't think I do, actually. No, because it's, you know, I know that there were collectors out there, I know there were fans of the show that really wanted to have something tangible, and I hung on to stuff for a while, and then I just offered it for sale. Somebody wants it, they can have it, but, you know, I gotta know they want it, and the only way I can really know they want it for sure is if they come up with some beans for it. I mean, you know, and I know, and I've met some of the people who have been collecting things at conventions, and I know that they want to keep it.
Yeah,
it's
yeah
not an article for they're not thinking of it as an investment for resale.
Right.
That's bound to happen from time to time. I know photographs that we've signed have shown up on eBay. And
sure.
But for the most part, it's, you know, I like that idea. I like the idea of bits from the show going to people who like the show and are going to keep them and say, yeah, gee, that was good.
I got my little piece of Lex.
Got my little piece of Lex.
Yeah, and that's a great thing.
I took my rock from the Grand Canyon. Now I got Lex.
Yeah, there you go.
I got my diamond from Africa. Now I got this. You know.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Do you have any of the episodes on DVD at all since they're out now and you can enjoy them without
all
commercials?
All my stuff I collected from production, it's all on VHS.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
the DVDs look great. I don't know if you've seen them. They look really good.
I've never. This friend years ago, late '80s. I wound up through a series of strange circumstances, spending about a month and a half in a little Greek village called Olympus, which is on the island on an island called Karpathos.
Yes, yes.
And the restaurant owner there and I, whose name is Vasilis Orfanos. And we got along great. And the day that myself and my friend were leaving, he called a bunch of people from the village. It's only like 150 people in the village. It's very kind of pretty, sort of, pretty isolated kind of a spot.
Yeah.
Way south in the Mediterranean.
Nice.
Sort of on a parallel with the island of Crete.
Very nice.
And called a bunch of people. And they made a circle and made us do this little dance. And they made us promise we would come back. Four or five years later, I come back. What are you, Brian, what are you doing now? I said, well, I'm doing a sci-fi show called Lex. Oh, Brian, you're a movie star. I said, no, it's a little sci-fi show on TV. Brian, you must show. What did I find? I don't see this anywhere. I said, listen, when I get back to Canada, I'll send you some tapes. Brian, you're in Canada. It's NTSC. Here, it's PAL. PAL.
That's right.
I said, okay, yeah, that's okay, man. I'll work it out. Forgot all about it.
Hmm.
I wind up going back again a couple of years after that. Brian, no tapes. Man, I'm sorry. God, what am I going to do? I'm not going to find him on this little island. His entire population is probably about, 8 or 10,000.
Yeah.
So we wind up doing, actually in 2001, we were in London and decided to like pop over to Greece and see, do a couple of things. And so I went to Forbidden Planet.
There you go.
In London, picked up as many copies as I could. Like there were two or three DVDs that I found there.
Yeah.
In the PAL form, because DVDs have even more formats around the world than VHS tapes.
Oh, they do. I know.
Stupid.
Yeah, it is crazy.
Stupid. Went to this village. I took a boat up to the village. Like a sort of a mini cruise ship. It's a day excursion boat, but it's a reasonable size. Get off the boat. Everybody's going up to this. Did I say that the town was called Olympus? It's not. It's
okay.
Called Diafani.
Diafani,
which
okay.
Which is at the bottom of a mountain. On top of the mountain is another village called Olympus. It's called Diafani. So I'm walking down the gangplank, and from way back, way up by the restaurant, there's two or three restaurants and a little hotel just set back a bit behind a few Greek sea pines there. So I went in the gangplank, and I see this little figure jump up, starts to walk down toward the boat, and I know it's one of the Greek guys because of the way he's dressed, and then he starts to run, and it's Vasilis.
Yeah.
This guy is like 5'4", picks me up off the ground, spins me around, and the other passenger's going to say, whoa. The little boys, they must have seen Brokeback Mountain before Brokeback Mountain, of course.
You
can see that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's a friend of mine. I've been here a bunch of times. So, yeah, we had a chat. And finally, I was able to give him some tapes. Now, I don't know, the DVDs. But the movie star is calm. Luca, mama, where's the Santino? It was
oh, that's funny.
Well, it was, it was really heartwarming, really pleasing.
Yeah. That's amazing about
those
people you
meet.
Those
are the only DVDs. Lex DVDs. Getting back to your question, do I have DVDs or what?
Yeah.
Those are the only DVDs, Lex DVDs I ever bought.
That's funny. That's a great story.
Yeah. There you go. None for myself, but now they're in Greece.
That's right.
I know they are.
He's enjoying them right now, maybe.
You never know.
Actually, I talked to Michael about this. The transition from Eva to Xenia, what was that like for you, as an actor, when that happened on Lex?
Paul Donovan has a very uncanny ability to put together teams that work.
Mm-hmm.
I work with Paul on a number of things. And I'm including crew guys, cast people, you know, down to craft services and all that kind of stuff. Production sometimes handles that, but Paul always pulls together these key people. And he's made, over the years, he's made a couple of mistakes. He's hired some people that didn't produce and were a bit difficult. But of the, like, thousands of people that we worked with just during the course of making four seasons of Lex, I can think of, like, maybe two, maybe three. I'm guessing there might have been three jerks. But everybody, just fantastic. And so he knew that Xenia was going to be just fine with the crew and with the cast. And you must remember that there had been, I think, about a year and a half
right
between the wrapping the first four, the MOWs,
right,
what's called season one now,
yes,
and beginning season two,
right.
And we all knew well in advance, we knew Paul kept us up to date, kept me up to date because I was around, about what was happening with Ava.
Right,
and
right.
What I decided to do.
Right.
Sorry not to have her back, but respect her decision. There's somebody new coming in. We met her, and she was a very lovely woman. And
oh, yeah.
So there was no feeling of, there was no leap. It was just like we're stepping from, you know, this surface to another surface, which is just as smooth and equal. And they both had different attacks on the character, but you know, but there was nothing of earth-shattering significance that was different. You know,
right.
They both knew the character they were playing. Otherwise, Paul wouldn't have hired them. You know,
yeah.
And Paul would not have allowed that there was going to, that there would be a huge leap in how the characters were played. Not how they looked. How they looked had to be different.
Sure.
And it had to be explained. But how they played the character couldn't have been that much different. I mean, he didn't want it. I knew he didn't want it to be that much different. Every actor has a slightly different take, a slightly different look, and it's going to have a slightly different feel. And for some people, Ava was the only Zev that ever will be. And for some people, it's Xenia, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that. I take both, actually, myself.
Would you?
Yeah, I take both.
That'd be quite an evening for you, then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, it reminds me of Stanley in the Las Vegas hotel room.
There you go. Or
Barry Ed. Yeah, the potential of what could have happened to Stanley, but it was Stanley, so things didn't work out the way they worked.
People had asked. you know, well, Stanley, we're going to get laid. And I said, watch season three. Stanley's going to get overlaid. With peach and plum, and it came in applesauce and jam. Whoever came through that door,
that was great. I just had to throw that in. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Stanley was out of practice, you know.
Yes,
it's been quite a while.
Yes, he was. He was. But that was great. The Las Vegas one was one of my favorite ones. I think that was just with the mummy and everything. That was hysterical.
That was hysterical. Interesting episode.
The president on Air Force One. Talk about good satire there. Oh my God, that was one of the fall out of your chair kind of laughing moments. I remember quite well. And Lex gave me my share of those. So it's great to have those. They're still out there, and sci-fi needs to not forget that there's room for those kind of shows, as much as the more straighter, more traditional shows too. You know.
Well, see, the good thing about tradition is that tradition has to change or it's stagnant.
Exactly, yeah.
And, I mean, especially when you're talking about something that has a creative genesis.
Yeah.
You know, somebody has to come up with the idea, somebody has to write it, and it's really sad when you see people mimicking it, you know, copying other shows.
Yeah, oh, of course,
so
of course.
This kind of show, like, hey, you know, you can't tell me for a second that there aren't people out there in the United States and other countries with terrific imaginations, great ideas for shows, and you got some Yakko executive, you know, if it's not a BMW, he's not going to drive it. If it's not a Porsche, he's not going to park it in his driveway, you know. These are the guys that stifle creativity, that stifle the possibilities, because they do market studies. Well, you know what? The markets change, too.
They sure do.
So there has to be more adventure, more creativity, right at the top of the executive level. People say, you know what? I like this idea. I'm willing to bet that other people screw what the market study says. Who develops these market studies? guys want to, like, select people that are most like themselves for the most part. You know, they're not going to talk to people in Alabama. They're not going to talk to people in, it's the same kind of intention or expecting the same reaction, because when these studies are set up, there's an expectation. They have an idea of what the result is going to be, and they adjust for surprises. You know what I mean?
Well,
that's an anomaly, because people, like, you know, in the Northeast United States, they really liked it, but that's just strange.
Yeah.
That's an anomaly. We can't base our decision on that. Like, well, maybe you ought to.
Yeah.
Maybe you really ought to, because they eat fish, and they got, you know, it's brain food, so I don't know, you know.
I mean, thinking outside the box, that expression, I think in sci-fi especially, it's really called for. And I think, you know, like I said, it's great to have these traditional shows, but to think outside the box once in a while, like shows like Farscape and like Lex did, and look at the wonderful results that we had. And it just, you know, there's room for everything in science fiction. It just doesn't have to be the same kind of thing.
Well, I tell you, check out science fiction film, science fiction, pardon me, TV, some of the newer stuff. And I know that the stuff that I'm watching was not in production until after all our stuff has been broadcast, and there are a lot of ideas that I see being lifted from Lex. And I'm happy, and I'm happy that that's happening. I'm happy because, you know, it breaks some elements of that tradition that you're talking about in science fiction. It breaks some of those elements, takes them off, and puts in something new and something that's at least going to feel a bit fresh, and it's going to reach a wider audience.
Mm-hmm.
The wider audience could say, "That's interesting. That's good. I like that." You know, and that may give that impetus I'm talking about to executives in positions of power, people that can actually, you know, make or break a show, say we're canceling this, we're keeping that, may give them, like, the I don't know, the cojones, the resolve. You guys have no cojones. They got salaries. What do they need balls for? Some money, you know. May give them, you know, the sensibility, the, you know, the little bit of adventure. They can actually, you know, green light a show that really is different. I'd watch in a flash. You know? Anyway.
But yeah, you
bring on.
No, that's good stuff. Good stuff. Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time out. I'm glad we had a chance to hook up and talk and reminisce and just talk about what's going on now, too. And I think it's going to be great. People can look forward to seeing you at Timeless with your former guest stars, and I think our co-stars, I should say.
Yes,
and
co-stars, buddy.
Yeah, and not guest stars. You guys were always around each other. But
but
it'll be a lot of fun, and it'll be fun to see you guys on stage, and, you know, some of the old humor and the poking fun and all that stuff will come out, and it'll be great.
Old humor, new humor.
Yeah.
Not at all.
So it's like, where have you been? What's going on? That kind of thing.
I tell you, it's going to be fun with Ellen, because Ellen is always
very
quick on her feet.
Oh, she is.
She's a sharp lady. And she's one of those people that I know has always responded to fans. Always,
you
know,
yeah,
she understands the same sorts of things that I understand. Which is that, like, man, people that watch the show, of course we owe them a huge debt of gratitude. Of course we do. Can we make it up in some way? Freaking right, we're going to try.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay.
I'd like what you said the first time we did the interview about her, which she was about Lex. I forget exactly how you worded it, but it's
well,
like...
Well, here's what she said.
Yeah,
it's on a tape. It's on the making of for season 3.
Okay.
She said she was looking at an image of herself. This was shot in a production studio in Toronto, and there was an image on this. There was a screen by the side of her face, and on the screen there was her in a pot of boiling water.
Right, right.
Shot in an old fortress, just in Berlin. Fire underneath and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things she said was that, you know, usually the expression is less is more, but in Lex, more is not enough.
Nah, that's right. That was it. That's exactly. I thought that was a great quote.
It cracked me up.
That is phenomenal.
So
that is so phenomenal.
She definitely gets it.
Yeah, it is. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. If you can sum up the show in one sentence, that's it. That's it.
Looking at I did a tape of some stills. I put some stills on VHS tape, and I did a running commentary for the whole thing. And I'm looking at, and at the very end, I put a little tag on, and the tag is Nigel Bennett as Prince, about to be lowered into a fiery pit hanging from a bar. I mean, like, with candles all around. I'm thinking, holy Christ, man. How many TV shows do you see, like, a guy being lowered into a pit of fire?
Not very often.
Not very often.
Yeah. Not very often. Well, thank you, Ryan, again, for taking the time. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was fun for me, too, man.
And hopefully I'll be able to get there and see you guys. I, as a fan of Lex, too, I also want to go and see all of you together and to see you guys on stage, too.
We'll have fun.
All right, man. You take care.
Vancouver, that time in Vancouver,
yeah.
Such a beautiful
city. It was great. I was there last year. Beautiful city. Beautiful city. I love Vancouver.
Okay, buddy.
It's awesome. All right, you take care of yourself.
Thanks for the chat, Tony.
Anytime.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Besides thanking Brian, I'd like to thank Bill Wanstrom of Wanstrom & Associates for setting up this interview. And as we mentioned, don't forget Brian will be appearing along with his Lex co-stars Ellen Dubin, Xenia Seberg, Michael McManus at Timeless Destinations. Check out their website at timelessdestinations.com for more information on the convention, as well as admission prices and also the hotel. That'll be summer of 2006. Timeless Destinations. Great convention. Should be a lot of fun. I hope to be there myself. As we mentioned, you don't have to go to Greece to pick up the DVDs for Lex, but in case you meet the Vasily, then I guess you would get the DVDs. But you can pick them up at your local store. For Sci-Fi Talk, this is Tony Tolato. Thanks for listening.
This is Brian Downey. I play Stanley H. Tweedle on the Lex. The Lex is the most powerful destructive force in the two universes. Please tune in to Sci-Fi Talk, because it's one of the last good things on this stupid Type 13 planet. Ugh.